Blog Talk Radio.
Everybody, and welcome to a great Tuesday night here we have on Suspense Radio. We are going to jump right in with our first guest, and we are going to save the intros for later because we want to welcome, without a doubt, one of the best authors that has been here for the last 20 years with her character, Kay Scarpetta. And it's great to have Patricia Cornwell with us today with her latest book, Port Mortuary, that just came out. So, Patricia, we want to thank you so much for joining us tonight. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, and thank you. It's a real pleasure.
Yes, number 18, Kay Scarpetta. Can you believe it? Back in 1990, when you wrote Postmortem, I mean, 18 books.
I know. I don't know where these 20 years have gone because it is remarkable to think about.
I mean, it's basically like growing up with your child, watching them go to kindergarten, then go to high school, now off to college. You've built her from the ground up until now. I mean, do you kind of feel that way as you're building her over these last 18 books and 20 years?
I think that's what's really surprising to me is that I keep finding out new things about her. For example, in Port Mortuary, one of the reasons I decided to switch back to first-person point of view and let her really tell the story in her own voice, which is something I haven't done in 10 years, is I knew there was something in her past that had not been explored. We've not known much about Scarpetta, what I call in her pre-postmortem days, you know, before she was introduced in postmortem in 1990. She sort of arrived a rather fully conceived character who was already rather powerful. She was, you know, the new chief medical examiner of a big jurisdiction like Virginia. So, but what was the story about how she got there? What's the truth, and is there anything about it that maybe is something that's troubling to her? And so, so my point is, and of course that turns out to be very true in this new story, but I find out new things about her with every book, and that continues to astonish me because it seems like it's a bottomless well.
Right. I mean, you're talking about, you know, like you said, a character already kind of there, and you didn't really have the build-up that a lot of characters have by maybe starting as the small-town sheriff and then moving on to, you know,
exactly,
head of the FBI. So there's always the backstory, and writing in first person, like you said, you started out for 10 years writing it that way, then you switched, and now you've switched back, is it gives you that opportunity to show the fans and the readers exactly who Kay Scarpetta was and where she came from.
Well, and I think the other thing I've sort of decided after 20 years of this, you know, what's kind of interesting to reflect on is when I first began this series, and literally I was working on Postmortem in 1988, so it's even longer ago than people think because it took me a while to get it published. In the early days, the main character of that series really was forensic science and medicine because nobody was writing about it in the sort of detail that I was, and I literally would start a book and say, what am I going to show people this time that they've never seen before? And of course, this was before people were really using the internet. It was before any of the technologies that are so common to us today, and it was before these shows like CSI and all the rest of it. Now, of course, we don't even recognize the planet in terms of how different it is from what it was back then. And I began to realize, you know, the one thing that I have that it continues to be fascinating and is unlike anything anybody else has is really her. And so why not give people an incredibly intimate look at her in Port Mortuary, where literally it's not an accident that I actually, the book opens where you're in the shower with her.
Exactly. I mean, you started it right off going here to, you know, Dover, Port Mortuary, which a lot of people probably don't understand, is right off of the Air Force Base, literally off the runway, 70,000 square feet. And it's almost like, you know, like from Potter's Field when you wrote about, a lot of people really didn't know what Potter's Field was outside of, you know, I believe, you know, New York, where they just put the bodies, put the stones,
right.
And that's all
there is. Same with the body farm.
Yeah, body farms, the John and Jane Doe's.
Right, that if you hang out with the real people in the field, you know about these places, and then when you mention them to others, they go, the what? Is that a health
right.
club?
mm-hmm.
And the same with Port Mortuary. They don't. I mean, people. When you tell them, listen, it's if you watch the news when when the heavy lifters are bringing in the casualties from Iraq and Afghanistan, and you see these dignified transfers at Dover Air Force Base, that's why they're going there. It's because that's the Port Mortuary where the Armed Forces medical examiners are taking care of our war dead, and also other federal cases that, you know, that are special jurisdiction. What I love about these people, to me, they're the Green Beret and FBI of medical examiners, and they really do exist, and a lot of people don't know about them. So obviously, I thought, you know, I bet you Scarpetta's got some interesting affiliation with these people, and it's time to explore what it is and sort of blow her cover.
Exactly. And this is the most technologically advanced book and adventure that Kate had to go through. And you mentioned that this is probably one of the weirdest cases that she's ever come across. And does that have to do with the ever-changing technology that is out there, not just in forensic science, but in the world today?
It does, and what's really shocking about it is I'm not making this stuff up. I mean, if it's not being done, it's in the works. And, in fact, that's why I put that sort of acknowledgement page in the beginning where I point out the couple of things that I did make up, although they're within the realm of possibility. But to make it clear, the rest of it is true. You can Google these things. And what's the one death, and I have to be careful what I say about it because I don't want to give it away because there is an incredibly bizarre case. The book opens with when Scarpetta's cleaning up at Port Mortuary at Dover and getting ready to return to her brand new headquarters in Cambridge, Massachusetts. She's greeted with this terrible news, you know, that a body was delivered there the night before, and the next morning, the tray the body was on and the body pouch are full of blood. Well, dead bodies don't bleed profusely. And so the fear is that this person really wasn't dead when he was put in her cooler. So now she's got to figure out what on earth has happened here. Because if this is true, that's a good way to end her brand new empire. But that particular case and the injuries, the strange things that I describe, and eventually what you find out is the cause of all this, actually exists and you can buy it. And it was actually an investigator with the Armed Forces Medical Examiners that pointed out this particular thing to me and said, look how troubling it is what's available out there.
Exactly.
And I know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, I mean, we were talking about that kind of off the air a little bit. And the one thing that I find interesting, and everybody can kind of go, because you have a great question and answer on your website, which is patriciacornwell.com. And if people go to Q&A, they can see a conversation. And we're not going to bring up a lot of the questions that you've already answered because they can read them for themselves. But, and I know I'm not going to get it out of you, but You did say that there was definitely a surprise with the weapon that you can't talk about. How surprising was it? I mean, you don't have to say what it was, but I mean, how shocking was it when you saw it or you heard about it?
I'm still shocked by it, and I, you know, I really am. And that it's and by the way, I had a police friend of mine buy this particular thing, and then we went and experimented with it. So believe me, I know what it looks like, I know what it does, and I know what it sounds like, and all this sort of thing, and. You know, when people read the book, they should Google this particular thing. They can read all about it and let them decide what on earth does it mean that some of things like this are available for anybody to just pick up as long as they're, quote, over 18 years old. And, you know, it's just like the access to learning how to make bombs and all this that are on the Internet. We really live in troubling times. And, of course, the most recent with these WikiLeaks, It's a reminder of what I read the other day about the Supreme Court justices debating when our forefathers, you know, talked about the First Amendment and the Bill of Rights. They didn't know we were going to be living in a world like this.
No, absolutely not.
And how far do we go before the greatest weapon of all is information and we need to control it a little better?
Yeah, and are we really? Because like we were talking about the social network and everything is out there for people to see. Is it now just too much? Are we given too much information now to where we can't even wrap our head around it? And now with the Internet, you have to try to decipher what's real and what's not real.
I know. I deal with this all the time on Facebook. I get fans who write comments. You know, I go on there every single day and I really answer people's questions, and I post things and try to interact with them. And I've had a real, because I just started doing this a couple months ago, I'm brand new at it, I've had a real dilemma where people don't really believe it's me. They,
right.
They go, I don't believe that's really her doing this. And I'm going, hello, it's me. I mean, can you, I mean, I wouldn't let someone do this and then fake you out. But it is strange. People don't know what's real and what isn't real. And in, but to answer your question about too much information, I think there, I think we are overwhelmed with information and distractions. And I think the odd fallout of that is people are lonelier than they've ever been. And I read this constantly where people say, it's like I'm available 24/7, but I've never felt so lonely. And that's because people need to re-explore their interior space, which is what you do with reading. Reading and writing are one of the most therapeutic things on earth in terms of giving you great company. I am never lonely when I'm reading a good book, and I'm not lonely when I'm writing one. But I am sometimes very lonely if I fritter away all my time with other things. And so I think with what you're doing and what I'm trying to do and to encourage people, yes, it's great to interact, and it's even great to interact with people on your Facebook page if you're someone like me. Be reminded that stoking that imagination of yours and feeding your interior self and your inner self is one of the healthiest, most fulfilling things you could ever do.
And that's the thing that I believe that I were trying to get across. So like I said, I have two daughters here that are 18 and 13. I have two sons also that are 18 and 16. And they just can't seem to get away from, like, you know, like I mentioned before, I quit smoking 3 weeks ago. It's more difficult for them to put their cell phones down and actually do something or go outside and do something more constructive than it was probably me to quit smoking. And I just don't know if I can wrap my head around that, knowing that when we grew up, we never wanted to be in the house, and we were always letting our imaginations run wild. That doesn't seem to happen anymore.
I know. One can only hope that it will start swinging around a little bit the other way, that nature will seek some kind of balance, because, you know, it's just like I'm sort of optimistic, because I know there have been young people who aren't that interested in reading, and then as adults they become avid readers. You know, they discover something that makes them feel better and enriches their lives. And I think that this constant text messaging and doing all this type of thing, it's a little bit like junk food. The more of it you eat, the more dissatisfied you are, so the more of it you eat. And, you know, you have to hope it does swing around and people find some other uses of their time that, in my opinion, are a little bit more edifying. If for nothing else, for God's sake, don't text message when you're crossing a busy street.
Oh my gosh, I see that all the time. I'm amazed how there's not more accidents, to tell you the truth. I really don't get it. And then the app for your iPhone where you can literally have your head down and text and walk, and it will tell you whether or not you're going to run into something. Okay, that's a little too much. If you can't even lift your head up to see where you're walking, haven't you just? Why don't you
just
plug
it? Well, you know, I'm going to tell you though.
Just plug it into your arm.
This is not. It is counterintuitive and contrary to survival, because one of the things that makes human beings so interesting, and it's very much the core of what people like me write about in crime, is our situational awareness. You know, when you turn into a dark alleyway and you get that feeling of uneasiness, and you go, you know, I don't know why, but I'm just not going down this road here. I don't feel good about this. That's a situational awareness. Our brains are amazing at detecting things before we're conscious of them, of these things. And if you shut all that off because you're too busy with your head inside your cell phone, you're putting yourself at great risk. I mean, just look at, for example, the case that you just had several weeks ago right there in Beverly Hills with Ronnie Chasen. That's a perfect example, and I'm not saying that she was busy doing something else by any means. We have no idea what really happened there, but things can come out of nowhere, and the more that you have a situational awareness where you get a feeling and you acknowledge it, or you see a shadow move, or something just seems off, because you're awake and alert and you're not text messaging, you're not talking on your phone, the better your chances are that you may survive whatever it is.
Yeah, I mean, and you mentioned that this morning on when you were on Good Morning America, and everybody can watch that. I think it was like about a 5.5 or 6 minute piece that you had on there, where, you know, you kind of said one of two things kind of happened in that case, and I felt that was, you know, without a doubt true. I mean, it was either a hit or it was something, you know, just out of the blue. But you just have no idea. And I don't know if we're ever going to actually know the answer to that, because it's such
sure
a bizarre case.
That is a horrifying and really chilling case, but it's a reminder to me. You know, we're talking about going back to the days of post-mortem 20 years ago. At that time, the thing, if people said, what do you think is the most terrifying crime? And I would have said it's the sexual psychopath that crawls through somebody's window and does what the guy did in Postmortem in that novel, The Serial Killer. You know, we were all hung up on serial killers and Silence of the Lambs and Hannibal Lecter and FBI profilers and all this type of thing. Now, the type of predator that I'm afraid of is what I would call, you know, the terrorist that isn't necessarily, you know, a political or religious terrorist, but just somebody who decides to terrify people by simply walking into a shopping mall and spraying bullets everywhere, where your victims are nameless and faceless and you don't care who you kill, like this 19-year-old kid allegedly just tried to do in Portland, Oregon. So getting back to what you're saying about technology, now more than ever we need to have situational awareness. We need to notice what is going on around us, not only for our own safety, but for the safety of our neighbors.
And, you know, and here's a great question from a mother who's a great fan of Yurdich, and she just sent this in. She wants to know. She goes that she just finished reading Port Mortuary and walked into the living room and found her 11-year-old son reading it. And he looked up and said, wow, Mom, this is a good book. Can I finish it? What would you say to that?
Well, God, this is probably going to be controversial. I can't imagine that an 11-year-old boy would see anything in Port Mortuary that he doesn't see all over the internet and on television. And at least with my books, there's such a thing as morality and justice and decent people who are fighting evil. And I don't even think that Port Mortuary is, in my opinion, it's detailed in terms of the forensic pathology and the forensic science and the graphic detail of what goes on in a morgue, but I don't think it's a graphically violent book. You never even actually, you don't really see the killings occur except in one case on a videotape and even or recording, and even then you don't really know what happened. So I don't, it depends on the kid.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean that's interesting, because these books really, you didn't really write them for that type of, you know, genre, I mean, or that age group. But, you know, again, talking about how we're trying to get kids to read and whatnot, it's great to know that somebody that age wants to pick up your book.
Listen, as technically savvy as kids are, I mean, I'm talking about robotics and nanotechnology and superconductors and all, you know, unusual weapons and things like this in medicine and science, period. I think it's good for kids to be exposed to things like that. I think if I were a parent, though, I'd probably want to discuss the book with my child to make sure he's not going to get nightmares. But like I said, look at what's on TV. Look at the games, the video games. My stuff is pretty soft compared to everything else.
Really? Your stuff's not even a trailer
to some of this other stuff.
Yeah, the original Snow White. Without it, I mean, that's true. Because I remember, I actually listened to your first 8 books in audio form, and I got such great joy out of that, because it was like a production. I listened to the unabridged version, and it just was the greatest thing, and it just got me so entrenched in your stories.
Well, thank you, and I'm glad you listened to the unabridged, because it just kills me when they cut these things by for the abridged, and it's like a third of your book is gone.
Oh, yeah, and that's one of the reasons why I got it, because I listened to one, I believe it was like a John Grisham abridged version, then I got, or a cutout version, then I actually went back and read it, and I go, wow, I missed all of this stuff.
Exactly.
I go, why do they do that? So, yeah, and, you know, and then I just have one final question here, because looking back, and I know it's difficult to look back over 18 books and 20 years worth of Kay Starpetta, but this book is so kind of forward-thinking and in today's day age. Which book would you say, when you go back and you look, do you think was kind of the same way as Port Mortuary is, which is like the advanced part of Kay Starpetta, a little bit ahead of the times of what people know right now about what's going on in the technology of forensic science?
That's a really good question, and absolutely the answer would be Postmortem, believe it or not. That, you know, 20 years ago when I wrote that book, it made it made the rounds for almost a year, publishing houses rejecting it. They didn't know what to do with it because it was in laboratories. It was a woman doing autopsies in a morgue and talking about DNA and lasers and actually showing a scene with something like that. And this all seemed almost not only science fiction, but it was way too graphic. It was too hardcore for a lot of people. And, of course, now that seems sort of silly. But with Scarpetta, I always try to have her leading the way. Whatever's going to be next, I know she's going to head in that direction because that's just who she is. So, for example, when I heard that people are beginning to do virtual autopsies like in Australia and Switzerland and, of course, Dover, the Air Force Base there, the Port Mortuary there, all of our casualties get a virtual autopsy in addition to the traditional postmortem, and where you're using CAT scans and in some cases even MRI. I said, of course she's going to be doing that. So that's what she's now introducing into her own facility. Is it for those who are interested in that kind of technology, you're going to get to see her do a virtual autopsy in Port Mortuary.
Right, and it's fabulous. And Patricia, I'll tell you, we want to thank you so much for being on because we know you have to wake up early to be on IMUS, and everybody, you can listen, probably you can Google Don Imus' show and listen to you again coming on the radio that you're going to be on, and they can go to your site, patriciacornwell.com. Now they can follow you on Facebook, and everybody, it is actually Patricia talking to you, so don't think it's somebody else. It's actually her. All right, and you're doing such a great tour, too, on Port Mortuary. So a lot of people have a lot of chance to see you and talk with you. And thank you so much for coming on because it was such a joy to have you on. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was great fun. I hope to do it again.
Absolutely. So thank you so much.
See you next time.
We'll see you and have a great day tomorrow.
Thanks.
All right, bye-bye. So everybody, that was Patricia Cornwell talking about her latest book, along with a lot of other technology stuff that is going on in today's day and age with Port Mortuary. It was great to have her on to be able to answer all those questions because, you know, she is one of the leading, you know, without a doubt, one of the leading authors that is out there right now in not only forensic science, but with her author, you know, with her character, Kay Scarpetta. And you definitely want to get Port Mortuary to see the technology in action that is going on and to see exactly how it has advanced itself into today's day and age. And how, you know, everything is working. So she'll dispel a lot of the CSI myths, I believe, if you go get Port Mortuary, which is available now. So it was great to have her on. Now, she had to be up so early in the morning because she was doing IMUS. I do apologize that we could not get to, everybody. But we will have her back on because she was such a gracious guest, and she will come back on in the future. And, you know, hopefully we'll have her on longer, but she needs to get up early in the morning because she's in New York to do Don Imus' show, and he gets up at 6 o'clock, and she's going to be on early. That's why we went ahead and we're doing the intro now before Michelle Gagan comes on instead of before. So we wanted to make sure that we accommodated her just to be able to get her on. So now let's do some of the intro stuff that we're going to do. And that is, you know, like I said, Michelle Gagan's going to be on here in about 7 minutes. We're going to be speaking with her on her latest book, Kidnap and Ransom. The other thing that we're going to be doing is John Saul. We're going to have him on. And he's going to be a 30-minute special here coming up on December the 2nd. So you definitely want to come back and join that because we're going to be doing that one early in the day at 11:30. It's going to be live, but we're not going to be really taking any questions. I'm just going to be talking with him one-on-one for 30 minutes about his book that's coming out in paperback that he had, House of Reckoning, last year, and now it's coming out in paperback, and it's actually out now. I just saw it. So we're going to have a little, you know, 30-minute discussion about that and, you know, everything that he's been doing. And then we're going to have Friday. We're doing something a little different is we are going to have debut authors on the radio only. So that's something that we're going to have here is we're going to have three debut authors talking about their books here on Friday. And it's going to be a great thing that we need to do because we've never done this before. We've had debut authors on with other people, but this time we're going to do a little bit different to kind of let you guys know, aspiring authors, what they had to do to go down that road to get themselves published and how they had to do it. So it's going to be a little bit interesting on that front. So you guys can hear straight from people that just made it and their books just came out. You know, what's the publishing business been like for them? How do they have to do this? You know, what exactly they've had to do to get themselves going. And then you guys will, you know, be able to understand a little about what's happening in today's day and age, you know, with publishing. So like I said, you know, we're going to be able to have all those people on, which is going to be great. And what I want to do right now is I'm going to bring you all back here because 34 minutes now of Suspense Radio begins right now. So here we go, everybody. Like I said, 34 minutes of Suspense Radio now begins after we just had Patricia Cornwell on. Again, I do want to apologize for anybody that might have been on hold for Patricia to ask her or ask any questions. What we're going to do is this, is that, you know, we are going to email over your questions, and I will get them over to her. And if the answers come back, I will, you know, if she can answer them back, I will go ahead and I will send them out to you. We will have her back on. She did have to wake up extremely early in the morning. She is in New York on the East Coast, so it is almost 9:30 out there, and she is going to be on the radio at 6 a.m., and so I believe she had to get up at like 4:30 in the morning to be able to go and do the radio show for Don Imus in the morning. So, you know, again, I do feel bad for anybody who was on hold, but, you know, like I said, we will get it on. We will post your things on Facebook, so please go ahead and email over your questions. We will get them over to her and see if she can answer. She is going to be on a tour for quite some time, so we don't know exactly when that's going to happen. We were just so happy to be able to get her on. She was so gracious to be able to give us her time, you know, to come on. And I believe, you know, that if she was not going to be up early in the morning, she probably would have done a whole hour with us, and we wouldn't have been able to, you know, get, you know, people on and, you know, talk with her, because we know that she's a very popular author and she's just done so much great work, along with now donating her $250,000 Ferrari for auction for veterans, San Diego Veterans organization that is doing, you know, for the veterans. So, you know, she has done that, and that's going to go on December the 9th. And like I said, you can find all that out on patriciacornwell.com. So, it was just a great time to have her on, and so everybody can, you know, enjoy and, you know, be able to get with her. Now, we also, again, Michelle Gagan is going to be joining us here shortly, and she is going to be talking with her on her book, Kidnap and Ransom, along with, you know, the other things that she's done, because, you know, Michelle's done a great job. You know, she's a great thriller writer. And she's done some fabulous books, Gatekeeper, Boneyard, The Tunnel. She's had some anthologies. We were able to meet her at BoucherCon for the first time. And, you know, it's great to see, I guess, we talked about this, and this is like maybe a while ago, and it's just something that I kind of noticed, I think, way back when, and it, maybe it's coming up now, is that, you know, we're starting to see, you know, a lot of, you know, a lot more, you know, great thriller writers coming out that people, you know, you might not have noticed. And, you know, when you're looking back and you're trying to find something to read, a lot of people, unfortunately, and I don't understand why, they tend to only go to the things that they see right in the front of Barnes and Nobles, and they stay off the stacks, and they don't go back, and they don't look at, you know, the paperbacks. And you know, sometimes they overlook, you know, these great authors like Michelle. And so what I want to do right now is I want to, you know, welcome Michelle to the show. And I want to say, Michelle, you know, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's great having you. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, John. Thanks for having me.
Yes. So we met at BoucherCon. Now, we met briefly because that thing was back and forth so off and on. I didn't know where I was coming or going half the time. And I know you were, too.
It was crazy. It's always crazy.
It is. And so since then, Kidnap and Ransom, you know, can you tell everybody a little bit about, you know, the book, how it's doing, and, you know, ideas behind it and all that fun stuff that everybody likes to know?
It's doing well. Actually, the original idea for the book came to me a couple of years ago. I was researching my previous installment in the series, which is entitled The Gatekeeper. That book was all about immigration issues and a dirty bomb plot by hate groups. And while I was researching The Gatekeeper, I stumbled across this story about one of the world's foremost kidnap and ransom negotiators, who's named Felix Batista. And he was, I don't know if you remember the film Proof of Life, came out a few years ago with Russell Crowe and Meg Ryan.
I do remember. I didn't see it, but I do remember seeing about it.
Okay. Well, Russell Crowe played a character similar to what Felix Batista did for a living. I mean, Batista had personally negotiated the release of over 100 kidnap victims over the course of his career. And he went down to Mexico in December of 2008. He was the keynote speaker at a security conference talking to them about the uptick in kidnapping for ransom that's occurred in Mexico, largely because of all the drug cartel violence. And he was in a restaurant having dinner with some friends. He got a cell phone call. He walked outside to get better reception, and he was pushed into the back of a van and hasn't been seen or heard from since. And it was a really unusual case. I mean, it struck me, firstly, because of the irony that someone who, you know, did this for a living suddenly went from being the hero to becoming the victim. And it was also odd because usually there's a ransom demand, or when someone like that is killed to send a message, they're very clear about the message. You know, usually the body is displayed in some grisly manner, and yet nothing was ever heard of. His family didn't get any notification. They never found a body. And so they don't know if he's still being held in Mexico or if he was killed and buried and no one ever informed them. I mean, it was just a very unusual case. And so it was kind of in the back of my mind as I was finishing up writing The Gatekeeper. When I was done with that book, I started looking more into all the drug cartel violence and how things have really spiraled out of control in Mexico. You know, in some huge swaths of the country are now basically lawless. And so I came up with the basis for Kidnap and Ransom, which is that someone similar to Felix Batista gets kidnapped under similar circumstances. His company sends in an elite unit to get him back. Unfortunately, the unit ends up kidnapped as well. And so it kicks off this whole spiral and chain of events that leads to my main characters getting involved.
And so you, which is great too, because, you know, your books are very, you know, much forefront about what's going on today. And it's not just kind of the same old rehashing of things, but it's, you know, stories that are relevant to today's society, which makes them even more scary.
Yeah, that's always what I've tried for.
It does.
Particularly with the last two books. Yeah, I love doing research. And for me, what's so interesting about writing crime fiction is that I can kind of draw inspiration from real life and really delve into things and come up with, you know, unfortunately, as is the case with Felix Batista, I mean, sometimes you don't get all the answers in real life. Mm-hmm. But in fiction, I can make the story turn out however I want. So it gives me that level of freedom and the satisfaction of at least on the page, making sure that justice is done.
Right. And, you know, one of the greatest things is that I've tried to read true crime. I really have, Michelle. And I'll tell you, most of it is just so damn boring. I can't get through the first 50 pages. But it's great when someone like you takes almost like a true crime story, puts the fiction spin on it, makes it seem like it's real. So when people put the book down, you know, they kind of get the shakes, like, oh, are you kidding me? Oh, what? You know, it makes that much better than the actual, I guess, truth, even though there's truth involved with it.
Well, that's the goal. I mean, I'm hoping that they prove to be satisfying in the end.
I mean, does it make you, you know, as a writer, when you write these, do you actually get nervous and kind of scared when you're in the middle of this writing these stories?
Well, what actually happened with this book, which has never happened to me before, is that after it was released, I was contacted by a couple of people, including one of the men who was eating dinner with Felix Bautista that night, and told, you know, some of the suspicions that they had with regard to what happened. A friend of the family contacted me and thanked me for writing a blog post talking about the disappearance and, you know, shedding some light on the fact that he's gone and there's been no news for 2 years. So that was the first time that that's ever happened. Generally, I just don't really consider it. I mean, I do write fiction. I'm not particularly concerned about, you know, drug cartels coming after me. Or with the previous book, I had a lot of hate group information in there. And, you know, some of the worst research I've ever had to do. But again, I think that there's generally a disconnect. You know, I don't feel like – I've never not written something because I was afraid it would result in someone coming after me. I just don't think that happens very often. You know, I mean, you see people who are much more in the limelight, like Stephen King and John Grisham, and, you know, they walk around, Lee Child, and no one bothers them. So I think it's something you just have to put out of your head.
Right. I mean, and that is one of, I guess, the good things sometimes, which, you know, we try to change here with, you know, the magazine and the radio show, is making authors more like, you know, like people will know, like we just had Patricia Cornwell on, people are going to know Angelina Jolie is going to be Kay Scarpetta, but Patricia Cornwell could probably walk around and no one's going to know who she is. You know,
that's the thing. I think Lee Child said that he's been identified on the street exactly once.
Exactly, and the guy sold 100 million books, and no one knows who he is.
Exactly.
You know, I mean, even Stephen King, because the funny thing is, this is what I found funny from BoucherCon, too. I'm looking at the backs of these books, and I'm looking right now at a book, and I'm looking at somebody's picture, and I'm not going to say who it is. They didn't look like that when I met them at BoucherCon. I'm telling you that right now. There's no
That's
way
true.
I would
have We don't always have the most up-to-date author photos.
No.
It's thank not
God.
Mine, is it?
No, it's not. I'm not going to say who it is or who she is. I will say it's a she. But,
okay.
I mean, there's no way, unless someone had to introduce us, first of all, to this person, because there's no way I would have ever picked that out. And so that's the thing. You know, I think it's just the same one that they used for the last 20 years. But, yeah, so that's when – but when you're doing research and you're doing – and you're in the trenches and you have to go to these things, you almost feel like, of course, you're an investigative reporter. But I guess the reason maybe that you don't feel that scared of it is because – you're bringing this to light in a fictional setting instead of being the person who's, like, exposing them for real of who they are, maybe.
That's right. Yeah. I'm definitely, you know, I think it's, and, you know, I mean, I don't know. I know that John Sanford got an odd letter once from a fan who was in prison who, you know, there was sort of a vague threat in there. And, I mean, it's not to say that it never happens. But, again, I don't know if that guy would recognize John Sanford when he was walking down the street. I don't think he's changed his author photo in some time now.
Yeah, I don't think he has either. And I know David Morrell got sued by somebody. But he's like, okay, you know, well, the guy's never going to recognize David.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, unless you're literally trying to find them. But I guess that's just, you know, a little out there or whatever. But how would you say, as far as your series go, and how many books, do you know how many books are going to be continued here with the series and your character?
Well, you know, as of right now, I've written 4 books in this series, and there are 2 main characters. There's an FBI agent named Kelly Jones, and she has a partner who's not really a partner. He's now, by book 4, he's leading a kidnap and ransom firm, similar to the one that Felix Bautista worked for, and his name is Jake Riley. So for me, those two characters really form the spine of the series. You know, they are in all 4 books. Their personal and their business relationship goes forward a quantum leap in each book. And now, at the end of Kidnap and Ransom, something happens. The series is going to shift a little bit.
Okay.
I'm actually working on a standalone right now, which is set in San Francisco, because I've written books now set in Mexico, set in all across the Southwest, set in New England, and I really wanted to write something set in my own backyard so that I didn't have to spend hours and hours and hours on Google Maps and pouring through travel guidebooks. So
right.
I'm setting this one book in San Francisco. It's an idea I've had for a long time now, and I wanted to finally tackle it once I kind of drew this particular series arc to a close. I think after that, when I go back to the series, there will still be those two main characters, but what I want to do is I want to bring out some of the secondary characters who've been in the background, like Sid Clement, who's this former CIA agent who came roaring in Gatekeeper and kind of took over the whole storyline for a while. Kelly's partner, FBI agent Danny Rodriguez, I'd like to go back into him a little bit more. So I think what I'm going to do is let these two main characters drop into the background a little bit and dig a little more deeply into some of the other characters' lives. I know Tana French has done that with each of her books, and I'm such a huge fan of hers, and I think her latest one, Faithful Place, is hands down the best crime fiction novel that I've read this year. And I think it would be fun to do that with some of these ancillary characters that I've spent the last couple of years with but don't really know that well yet.
So basically your fans then get a seat, because I just want to remind everybody, we're talking here to Michelle, and I'm terrible with last names, but it's
Gagnon. Oh, I have a tricky one. It's Gagnon.
Gagnon, okay.
Yeah.
So we've been talking here with Michelle Gagnon, and your website is Michelle Gagnon, GAGNON.com. And the four books, just so people know, we're talking about, the latest one is Kidnap and Ransom. But then going back, we're talking about The Tunnels, Boneyard, and then the last one that you just had was The Gatekeeper, to be able to talk about your characters, Jake Riley and FBI agent Kelly Jones. And that's a very interesting thing that you're doing, is to take your main characters, still have them in your books, but not have them in the forefront, instead of basically taking the other characters and making their own maybe standalone book themselves. Very interesting concept that you're going to do with that.
That's the idea. I mean, we'll see what happens. You know, once I finish the book that I'm working on right now and I go back to them, I might have a change of heart. I mean, I am very tied to those characters. But it was just something that, you know, I felt like they've really sort of owned the storyline now for four books, and it might be time to give someone else a chance.
Do you kind of feel a little sense of nervous or anxiety knowing that this is something that you put in your mind that you're going to try to tackle?
A little bit. I mean, I've already discovered working on this standalone that it's been challenging to start a book basically from scratch. I mean, not that, you know, every book starts that way, but at least with the series, after the first book, I knew two of my characters really well. I mean, I had their voices in my head. I knew how they would react to specific situations. I, you know, had a really clear sense of their pasts and their relationship to each other. And so working on this standalone, I mean, it's been a little tricky building characters again from the base up and trying to rediscover a completely different story that's, you know, doesn't involve the FBI this time in any way, shape, or form. So that's been a little bit of a challenge, and I think it'll be interesting to go back to the series then and see some of those other characters in a different light. I think it'll be, you know, kind of like looking at it from a different angle.
Now, one of your fans here asked a question. They want to know, what's the one piece of advice that you've gotten as an author from maybe somebody else, like an agent or another author or somebody, that you felt has really benefited you the most?
I think the most important thing that I learned, and it was actually a trial and error thing for me, I have a book sitting in a drawer that will probably never see the light of day.
I think every author does. I hear that every time in every interview.
Yeah, pretty much. And the mistake that I made was I literally wrote the end and was so convinced that it was this work of unparalleled genius that I immediately sent it off to 50 of the top New York agents, and then sat back and waited and, you know, watched as the rejections started trickling in. And I realized when I picked it back up about a month later saying, well, what are these people talking about? Why aren't they rushing to represent me? I read it again and realized, oh, no. I mean, it's really kind of a mess. And so, I mean, for me, the ideal, it's a little tricky with the book a year schedule, but my ideal is to be able to put the book away in a drawer for a month and not look at it, not think about it, go on and start writing something else. I usually try and start working on the next book while the current one is percolating in that drawer. And then I really can go back to it with fresh eyes. That's hands down the best advice that I've ever gotten, is just to put it away, let it go, and then when you come back to it, you can really see it again.
So do you kind of write, because I wrote a blog piece today that I kind of put out there, which was plots versus characters, and I said that, when I said that way back in time, like my English teacher would always be like, okay, you know, write the outline to your plot, and then I want to see what it is, and then that's what you have to write your story on. But I always felt that I think the characters are the ones that drive the story more than the plot does. So my kind of looking now is that when you put that book away and you start writing on something else, and then you bring it back out and you say, okay, now we're going to start, you know, looking at it again, what's the first thing that you start looking for to see if you want to change? Is it the plot or is it the character kind of aspect of it?
It's really varied book to book. I mean, I'm not an outliner personally. I know it works, that works great for some authors, but I literally don't usually know how a book's going to end until I write the ending. That being said, the overall plot points for the first three books were fairly fixed once I got them in place. When I brought them back out, I had to, I think in Boneyard, I added in one character and storyline because my editor pointed out that, you know, with the case that they were working, there would probably be a media angle. So I put in a news reporter and had her contribute to the story. With Gatekeeper, really, Gatekeeper was a matter of trimming. I mean, that book was a monster initially. It was 150,000 words. I had to cut out a third of it between the first draft and the second. With Kidnap and Ransom, that was the very first time that I actually had to rewrite the ending five times. I've never had to do that before. And I just had a really, it was very hard to get right. I really wanted to remain true to the characters, and I know that in the end I came up with something that was probably a little bit unexpected, but was the only thing that worked. I mean, I tried it four other ways, and I've been getting letters from people who read the book who are sort of mixed opinions about the ending. Some people loved it. Some people were a little upset by it, but, you know, it was an interesting experience to write it because I felt like, okay, I tried. I mean, I tried all these different ways, and this was the first time I said, okay, this is the one. Like, I've done it over and over again, and this is the only one that really works.
And so when you get those letters, whether they're, you know, good or bad, kind of, you know, for someone who's, I guess, kind of new, because now that you've been in the fourth, and I'm sure you've gotten, you know, many letters on many of your books, a lot of people don't take criticism well. So when you get those letters, kind of, how does it make you feel, whether someone says, God, I can't stand what you did, why did you end it that way? You know, what do you, what's kind of like your first reaction now as compared to back when you first maybe really got them? You just want to say, yeah, well, you just get all mad. But now, what? How do you act kind of now on those things?
Well, luckily, most of them have been positive. But the ones that I get that are negative tend to follow a couple of themes. And one of them is I got a bunch of letters after writing The Gatekeeper. People were complaining about all of the F-bombs. And the thing is that there's this group of guys who are former special forces soldiers, just basically got back from Afghanistan and Iraq. And, yes, their conversation with each other is sprinkled pretty liberally with some strong language.
Yeah, they didn't know when to watch Platoon. I mean, come on.
Exactly. I mean, that was the thing, is I felt like, you know what, I would be candy-coating it if I had them speaking any other way. The other one, probably the most letters of complaint that I ever received on anything involves a scene in Boneyard. And in the scene, there's a birder who who is a plot device. I mean, basically, you know, he's out in the woods in New York. He basically has the sighting of a lifetime. He sees this amazing bird. He's so thrilled. And at the same time, he stumbles across something else. And the bird that he sees, I had contacted the New York Birding Association. They said for that area it would be the Kirkland's warbler. I said, great, put it down, double-checked it. Well, somehow in the editing process, it got one of the letters got changed from a K to a T. So it came out the Kirtland's warbler. And I got probably 50 or 60 letters from enraged birders who said that they were loving the book up until the point where the bird's name was misspelled, and that completely ruined the experience for them.
Are you kidding me?
No, I'm really not. And there's just nothing you can say to that. I mean, it wasn't, you know, it was an honest mistake. It happened. I'm hoping at some point down the line I'll be able to change it in future editions. But, you really can't get angry about that.
You just kind of, I guess you just got to laugh, you know?
You have to laugh.
You just got to laugh about that one. Of all the things people pick, you spelled the name wrong, it just killed it for me. Okay,
but
really?
I think almost every writer says that. It's always the thing that you don't expect. I mean, in that same book, almost the entire book is really faithful to the geography of the section of the Berkshires where it's set, and yet in one scene I needed to have a limestone quarry. So I put one in there and expected that I was going to get a ton of letters from people who lived in and around there who were like, what are you talking about? There's no quarry. Nothing.
Nothing
at all. Nobody wrote
nothing.
You can apparently drop a limestone quarry in the middle of a place where none have existed, but God help you if you misname a bird.
Really, let's put a gold mine right in the middle of Ohio and talk about that. And people be like, I never knew it was there. Are you kidding me? Let's go see that out. Yeah, no. Misspell a bird. People are very, very picky about their animals.
They really are. It's
true. And so, I mean, I guess if you're at a book signing and you just got to picture that and someone comes up and says that to you and you never had a letter about that before, first your mouth would probably fall on the floor and you'd probably turn red and really not really know what to say. They probably would catch you speechless at that point.
Usually I just give them a really heartfelt apology.
Yes,
you know, I mean, these things happen.
Yeah, they do. I mean, and so speaking of kind of going on the road, I see, you know, that you did some book signings and, you know, for your events, and you already have some stuff planned here for 2011. How do you, you know, like to go out on the road now and do those things? I mean, is that something that, you know, is fun for you? Does your publisher help you? Or are you kind of doing all of this on your own that you're going out to these places?
It's been a bit of a mix. I mean, I definitely didn't travel as much with this book as I have with the previous ones. Just because, you know, it was, I think, with The Gatekeeper, I was gone 26 days out of 30 over the course of November. And it was just madness. You know, it was terrible for me. It was terrible for my family. I was exhausted. I barely got any work done. And, you know, while I love meeting the booksellers and going to the stores and, you know, meeting people who have enjoyed reading the books, it was just extremely exhausting. So I decided that this time I was going to limit that as much as possible. I was going to do more stuff like this online and call in radio shows. It's just been saner. I mean, especially now I'm working on a book. I'm working on a screenplay.
Oh, really?
Yes. I'm co-writing a screenplay with a friend of mine, which is going great. So it's been busy, and I'm honestly relieved that I haven't had to go through the new TSA pat down yet.
Yeah, I know. We just took our in-laws through LAX, and you know, we were curious to know if whether or not they're going to have to get naked. But we thought it was, we thought it was really funny. The guy who went through LAX and just took his pants off when he walked through and said, "There you go." Go ahead. I'm just walking through. Do it up.
Yeah. No. I'm glad that I'm missing most of that.
Yeah. I mean, and that is good because I guess with book signings, but with, you know, like we were talking to Patricia, with all the new technology, and you can go on your contact page and you see, you know, that you're on MySpace and Facebook and LinkedIn and Redroom and Shelfari and Goodreads and Twitter, that you're really utilizing the internet that way instead of, I guess, going face to face with people. Because, you know, a lot of the times book signings, you know, a lot of authors say you don't really get the hit that you really want, and you can do more and reach more people by doing technology. So I think that a lot of those are, you know, a lot of those on appearances, you know, on, I guess not really on screen, what did I say, you know, kind of personal appearances are kind of going away, and they're also damn expensive when the publishers aren't going to pay for them.
They are, and, you know, and they're expensive for the publishers. I mean, I think it's unfortunate. I try to do a mix as much as possible just because I do love bookstores, and it saddens me that so many independent bookstores are being forced to close. And I'd love to give them, you know, as much support as I can. When I do tour, I usually only tour at independent bookstores. I also think that, you know, the social media are a fantastic way to reach people in places that I could never go to. You know, I think one of my Facebook followers from the beginning has been this guy, Bill, in the Midwest, who, you know, lives in a small town and who I would never be able to actually, you know, I'd have to literally fly in and just see him. And yet, you know,
hey, Bill,
thanks
to
Facebook and MySpace, we've become actually pretty good friends. And so I think that's an amazing thing. I think especially for someone like me who works from home, it's great to have a virtual water cooler. Mm-hmm. The trick is to make sure that it doesn't monopolize too much of my time, because I can definitely get sucked into the internet void.
Yeah, it really can. And here's another thing, and I don't know if you do this or not, but if there's like a book club, you know, maybe there's like 10 or 15 people that get together once a month, and they want to go ahead and, you know, they want to use your book, Kidnap and Ransom, which is available now, so people need to go out and get it, and use it for their book club, and they contact you through your website, Michelle Gagnon, GAGNON.com, would they be able, you like all those plugs, would they be able,
thank you,
would they,
the check's
would
in
you
the mail.
Be able to, yeah, would you be able to call in and maybe talk with them about the book for maybe a half hour so they can hear right from you and understand? Because I think some authors are starting to do that we hear on the radio when they talk with us, that they're doing that.
Oh, absolutely. I love doing that. And I also think it's good to do that. It's almost better sometimes by phone, because then they can hang up on you and talk about what they really thought.
Yeah, the old line that I always loved was from Back to School, where Rodney Dangerfield had Kurt Vonnegut come in and write his paper. He turned it in, he got an F, and the teacher, I think it was Sally Kellerman, said, "Whoever wrote this paper doesn't know the first thing about Kurt Vonnegut." And I always find that funny, because English teachers just seem to not get it sometimes.
Right.
And so it's always good to hear straight from the author, because we were listening to John Conley, and my daughter's boyfriend was writing a book about the Whisperers, and he had to write about what the book was like. And I said, you know what, let's just email John and ask him, and he'll tell you. And there was really nothing to it. He's just a story. No rhyme or reason behind it. It was just a story. Well, the teacher didn't like that. But that's what it was.
Wow.
It don't all have to be that way. So.
Yeah.
But I'll tell you. Well, Michelle, it has been such a pleasure to have you on. We really appreciate it. Again, everybody, that's Michelle Gagnon. It's GAGNON.com. And the book is Kidnap and Ransom. And
great.
It's doing
Thank
wonderful.
You, John.
So, yes, Michelle. But we'd love to have you back on to talk about the latest thing that you're doing, because it is the standalone. And then to see how, you know, you're working that, you know, next angle by taking Jake and Kelly and putting in the background and bringing those other characters up and kind of seeing if you're still going that direction or how you're doing it. Because I really want to know how that's working out for you.
Okay, well, I'd be happy to come back on.
All right. Well, again, thank you so much, Michelle, and you have a great night.
You too. Thanks, John.
All right. Bye-bye. So, again, everybody, that is Michelle Gagnon, and that is her book, Kidnap and Ransom, available now. You need to go pick it up. And while you're out, you know what, just go get The Gatekeeper, go get Boneyard, go get The Tunnels, read the whole series. You know, get them as Christmas gifts, hand them out to your friends, and, you know, it's all available, ebook, Barnes & Noble, all over. It's a book that you're going to have to go, and you go in, you get all four, boom, right there. Order them from Amazon, Barnes & Noble, wherever you buy books. Well, it has been such a fabulous show. We want to thank everybody for being with us tonight. You know, we got about a little less than 2 minutes to go right now. And Patricia Cornwell here was on first. We will try to get her back on again. She had to wake up early, and her book is Port Mortuary, the 18th book now in the Kay Scarpetta series, and they just keep getting better. It's definitely one that you want to stay with, because Kay Scarpetta now is her biggest technology story that she has been with to date. So you want to go out and get Patricia Cornwell's book, Port Mortuary. Michelle Gagnon, you want to go out and get her kidnap and ransom, support the authors, go to the shelves, go find it, go read, use your imagination, everybody. Keep writing. Any aspiring authors, let us know what's going on, how you're doing. We are going to see you Friday with our debut author radio show to hear it from them, what they had to go through, what road they had to go down. So anybody curious to know, you can come with us. Again, my name is John Robb. I want to thank you all for joining us tonight for this video. We'll be with you Friday, 6 p.m. All right. Good night, everybody.